Welcome, everybody. Today is July 5th. Welcome to Renegade Roundtable. And I'm your host, Nick Spiro. Thank you very much, Kyle, for inviting me to host this roundtable this evening. And if anybody would like to call in and join me, the guest call-in number is 347-633-9657. So please join it. It is a roundtable. I titled the show Operation Wetback. And we've got a immigration problem, not only in America, but all over white countries. Why do these non-whites want to be here in a white country? What is so wrong with where they live? Why do they have to be here? Seems as if the Jews are giving these people everything that we as white people have worked hard for centuries. America's a fairly new country compared to European nations. Even South Africa is much older as far as its existence with America and Australia. And we even have Argentina as a fairly white country, New Zealand. And I might be forgetting another one. Well, Canada, of course. But we've got these immigrants, these illegal invaders coming into America, and this has been an ongoing problem. It's just not today. It just seems that it's more evident that it is a problem. I've been looking at some videos that were taken in 1996. This was a time in California where they were looking to propose, well, it was called Proposition 187, interesting name. So Proposition 187, what is that? Well, like most things in America, seems like everything, the trend started in California when it comes to a blanket reform or bill or act. And Proposition 187 was passed, but shot down soon after. So in November 8th, 1994, Proposition 187 was passed. It was called the Save Our State Initiative. And a federal judge eventually blocked this proposition. December 14th was when it was to be looked at again in 1994. But the major provisions of this was, first, it bars illegal aliens from the state's public education systems, from kindergarten through university, and requires public educational institutions to begin verifying the legal status of both students and their parents. California education institutions verify the residence, but not the legal status of pupils and students. This is back then. There are no tuition charges for K through 12 education. One of California's three higher education systems, the state university system, charges resident illegal aliens lower in state tuition, while community college and UC charge them higher out-of-state tuition. Second, all providers of publicly paid non-emergency health care services must verify the legal status of persons seeking services in order to be reimbursed by the state of California. Third, Proposition 187 requires that all persons seeking cash assistance and other benefits verify their legal status before receiving benefits. Fourth, all service providers are required to report suspected illegal aliens to California's Attorney General and to the INS, and police must determine the legal status of persons arrested. Fifth, the making and the use of false documents is now a state felony. So that all sounded great. And when I got into this type of information back in 2007 in my research in this journey, I thought the ACLU was something that we should praise, and it was for the people and against this evil tyrannical government. But it appears and it shows that the ACLU was fighting this all along on behalf of these invaders. So after it was suspended and postponed, it eventually was voided in 1999 altogether. So nothing ever came out of it as far as actually passing. I mean, it was approved, but then when the federal district judges and Supreme Court got involved on behalf of the ACLU, it was shut down. So in 1999, here is a press release from the ACLU. A court approved mediation today, ending years of legal and political debate over Proposition 187, a controversial ballot measure that sought to limit services to illegal immigrants. The agreement confirms that no child in the state of California will be deprived of education or stripped of health care due to their place of birth. It also makes clear that the state cannot regulate immigration law, a function that the U.S. Constitution clearly assigns to the federal government. Passed in November 1994, Proposition 187 sought, among other things, to require police, healthcare professionals, and teachers to verify and report the immigration status of all individuals, including children. Days after the measure passed, a federal district court held that it violated the United States Constitution and issued an injunction barring its implementation. Today's agreement validates that ruling. Here's a quote. The seal of the great state of California is now stamped on the death certificate of Proposition 187, said Mark Rosenbaum, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California, a litigant in one of several challenges to the measure. The court-approved stipulation marks not just the end of this case, but an end to nearly 5 years of racial divisiveness throughout California. California's Assembly Speaker Antonio Villaraigosa, who participated in the mediation, agreed. Today's settlement signals that it's time to move beyond the divisiveness of Proposition 187. The decision ensures that children can get an education, working families can get health care, and law enforcement can focus on fighting crime. We stand together today to say in one loud voice that Californians are tired of wedge issues and cultural wars. So I wanted to start off with that for this roundtable. And let's see who's on the call. I don't see anybody yet. Please call in. It is roundtable. I didn't plan on doing this show all by myself. So again, the call-in number is 347-633-9657. Okay. So then, a way that this was not able to fully go through was basically because President Clinton signs the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, PRA, of 1996 into law. The PRA creates a statutory scheme that restricts and defines the eligibility of certain non-citizens for federal, state, and local benefits and services. Then, in September 30th, 1996, President Clinton signs into law the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, IIRA, further supplementing the Federal Immigration Regulatory Scheme. So, March 13, 1998, the District Court issues decisions ruling that Sections 1 and 4 through 9 of Proposition 187 are preempted by the federal PRA, IIRA, IRA, and other federal laws. So basically what happened with the passing of these acts from President Clinton, it basically shot down Proposition 187 altogether to where it became null and void for the most part because of the federal rulings and acts that Clinton passed. And let's go to a rewind. We had Reagan in 1996. So again, it's two opposites of the same coin. You've got Republican, Democrat. Reagan passing the Immigration Reform Act, and Reagan actually used the term amnesty in a speech. So it's the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, IRCA, and for the most part, it was supposed to pretty much bail out all the illegal immigrants, invaders, that were already in the country and have them come forward to become naturalized citizens or whatnot. And obviously it did not work. So we go back in time. We have a guest worker program that was started right after World War II, 1942. Basically, in a nutshell, to bring in migrant workers to work fields and lower skilled positions, which I find interesting. You bring in people with low education levels and lower skills, they're more than likely going to resort to a life of crime. But the whole concept of American people supposedly not willing to do this type of work is what I hear amongst, I don't know, even white Americans, unfortunately, but it's used quite a bit in speeches and quotes, radio shows, podcasts, whatnot, media, stating that American people aren't willing to do these type of jobs. I find that bullshit. But this is what the excuse is. So this guest workers program started in 1942, an agreement between the United States and Mexico, and it was named the Bursario program, and there's other names, the H-2 visa program, and another one, H-2 program. There's H-2A and H-2B. There's some differences. You guys can Google that. But for the most part, it didn't stick around very long, supposedly. Obviously, we do have a guest workers program today. It lasted from 1942 to 1964, but in the meantime, in between those years, there was 1954 Operation Wetback. President Eisenhower created that concept, and I think Kyle posted this on Renegade, the Christian Science Monitor article, how Eisenhower saw the illegal border crossings from Mexico. So that's a good read. We can get into that if you guys like, since nobody is calling in. Nobody has called in yet. Other than that, we've had some good shows on Renegade. I'll go through the schedule here again. Mondays, we got the wild card. On Tuesdays, you got Drew. Wednesday, Paul Hickman. Thursday, The Observer. Friday, we have Dana and Tykus. Saturday, The Roundtable. And Sunday, Kyle Hunt. Kyle Hunt just did an interview recently with Red Ice. That should be posted shortly on Red Ice Creations, as well as Mammy Shit. And I would like you guys to input on what we see going on throughout the world with these invaders and immigration policies that are failing. So please call in. Other than that, I can discuss some other things. We've got Pete Santilli over at the Mexico border. I don't know if he's working with these one percenters. I've seen him on with a lot of bikers. Not sure how they come into play, but there were over, I don't know, a couple hundred bikers going towards the Mexico border last time I checked on video. Not sure what they're going to accomplish, but yesterday there was a situation that occurred at Murrieta, California. There were about 10 communist immigrant invader supporters that were arrested. It's kind of nice to actually see Antifa finally getting arrested. Usually they're protected. And nothing usually happens to them. Like what happened in 1996 on July 4th, the federal building in California. There were about 200 middle-aged white folks, more than likely fighting to keep or have Proposition 187 passed, but the 200 white folks, middle-aged, who were out there, unfortunately there were no younger guys out there to protect these older folks because they were viciously attacked by hundreds of these Antifa, mostly Mexicans. There was a nice mixture of different races there. There were even whites and probably Jews there standing behind these immigrants. But the vicious attacks definitely came from mostly non-whites on the white folks. And I saw blood, huge gashes in people's heads and arms and backs and chest and you name it. And there were no arrests that took place from what I saw in the video, unfortunately. So at least 10 people were arrested the other day. Not sure what's going to happen with them. More than likely be released and nothing really of any consequence happening to them. So if we have any callers, please call in. I don't want to be the only one doing a roundtable. This isn't very fun. I do shows on Thursdays on Circus Maximus, but typically I have a guest to bounce ideas off of. I didn't plan on a two-hour show to do solo. So I could use a little help here. And with some of the shows that I've been listening to recently, I heard the Observer show, and it looks like Observer is moving to Maine. I wish him luck, and I wish him well. He was on my show recently, and I think we had a really good show. We discussed mostly fascism and what it is, and other ideologies that could be implemented as a bag of a mixture of ideologies that can be thrown into the mix in order to resolve our issues here in America as well as other white nations. And the other show that I heard, Drew did a really good show on immigration. That was last week, though. He interviewed Kevin Summers. I didn't get to listen to all of that. And then I heard Dana's show, and Dana's going through a hard time, and he could definitely use our support, our strength, our wisdom, any positive vibes we can throw out at him. I know addiction is a rough road to lead in. I've been there. As far as my past goes, I had a 6-month heroin addiction myself. I did go to rehab, and I never went back. I kicked it and never turned back to it, and it was rough. It's something that I don't wish on some of my worst enemies. Something that eats away at the soul. It's something that destroys families and quality of life and sanity. It's your life, your mindset revolves around getting your next fix. I was going to college and I was going to DeVry and couldn't even finish school because at that time, it was in the time of my addiction. So I asked for help from my family and they gave it to me and I rode with it and never turned back. And it's tough. My brother died from it August 23rd, 2011. So this year will be 3 years from when he overdosed. It's something that has been an issue for centuries. The opium wars over in China, I would imagine even before that. But the processing of it, what they do to it. They obviously make it something that is so addictive that once, I think Alex from Serbia said it best in the comment on Dana's show, that it disrupts your opiate inhibitors and whatnot, and one of your neurotransmitters, I forget which one. But basically, in a nutshell, you become dependent on it, and it's almost like you can't live without it. Otherwise, you're sick, you're nauseous, you feel like you want to die, your stomach cramps up. It's like a flu, but on steroids. It's so intense. It's rough. And not many people are able to kick that habit. So I quit back in 1997, I would say. Yeah, 1997, and I had a six-month habit. I never shot. I snorted it. But I've seen what it does to people in general, especially with my brother. I tried helping him. All of the family did. So Dana or anybody else, it's something that you could use help with if you can get it and take advantage of it if you can. I don't want to really beat up a dead horse, so please call in. It would be great to have some callers. And then on Monday, we had Nick, Nor Remorse, host the wild card. So I'm going to take a break, and hopefully some people join me on this call. I'm going to play a song. I don't know which one yet, but I'll just play my closing tune that I normally play on my show. Thank you.
Canta la lupara, una carogna grida e mori, questa legge dura e amara, all'infami spacco cori, non dubitti o sapnenti, vuole Dio mi preie santi, o colpevoli o innocenti, ognuno facile o mercanti. Omertà, omertà, chiste leggi società, leggi chi non perdona, a stupaci infamità. L'omertà è comandamento, est legge saggia e giusta, u prestauro giuramento, lo sgarrare assai in cicusta, so più degno ma non viro, sogno sordo e puro muto, sacci regoli di Dio, ma resto sempre in un tambuto. Omertà, omertà, chiste leggi società, leggi chi non perdona, occupaci infamità. Orbo sogno, all'onorata ci appartegno, società cantano pugno, ci comanda tutto il regno, e l'uomo chi parra assai, si trova sempre in tali guai, quest'urdo orbe taci, campa vicent'anni in pace. omertà, omertà, chi se leggi società, leggi chi non perdona, a tu faci infamità, omertà, omertà, chi se leggi società, leggi chi non perdona, accufaci famina.
Well, I'm back, and I still have zero callers. Anyhow, I'm going to read this, how Eisenhower saw the illegal border crossings from Mexico. Oh, this was July 6, 2006. Christian Science Monitor. Washington. George W. Bush isn't the first Republican president to face a full-blown immigration crisis on the U.S.-Mexican border. 53 years ago, when newly elected Dwight Eisenhower moved into the White House, America's southern frontier was as porous as a spaghetti sieve. As many as 3 million illegal immigrants had walked and waited northward over a period of several years for jobs in California, Arizona, Texas, and points beyond. President Eisenhower cut off this illegal traffic. He did it quickly and decisively with only 1,075 United States Border Patrol agents, less than one-tenth of today's force. The operation is still highly praised among veterans of the Border Patrol. Although there is little to no record of this operation in Ike's official papers, one piece of historical evidence indicates how he felt. In 1951, Ike wrote a letter to Senator William Fulbright, Democrat of Arkansas. The senator had just proposed that a special commission be created by Congress to examine unethical conduct by government officials who accepted gifts and favors in exchange for special treatment of private individuals. General Eisenhower, who was gearing up for his run for the presidency, said amen to Senator Fulbright's proposal. He then quoted a report in the New York Times highlighting one paragraph that said, "The rise in illegal border crossings by Mexican wetbacks to a current rate of more than 1 million cases a year has been accompanied by curious relaxation in ethical standards extending all the way from the farmer exploiters of this contraband labor to the highest levels of the federal government." Years later, the late Herbert Brownell, Jr., Eisenhower's first attorney general, said in an interview with this writer that the president had a sense of urgency about illegal immigration when he took office. "America was faced with a breakdown in law enforcement on a very large scale," Mr. Brownell said. "When I say large scale, I mean hundreds of thousands were coming in from Mexico every year without restraint. Although on and off guest worker program for Mexicans was operating at the time, farmers and ranchers in the Southwest had become dependent on an additional low-cost, docile, illegal labor force of up to 3 million mostly Mexican laborers." According to the Handbook of Texas Online, published by the University of Texas at Austin and the Texas State Historical Association, this illegal workforce had a severe impact on the wages of ordinary working Americans. The Handbook Online reports that a study by the President's Commission on Migratory Labor in Texas in 1950 found that cotton growers in the Rio Grande Valley, where most illegal aliens in Texas worked, paid wages that were approximately half the farmers' wages paid elsewhere in the state. Profits from illegal labor led to the kind of corruption that apparently worried Eisenhower. Joseph White, a retired 21-year-old veteran of the Border Patrol, says that in the early 1950s, some senior U.S. officials overseeing immigration enforcement had friends among the ranchers, and agents did not dare arrest their illegal workers. Walt Edwards, who joined the Border Patrol in 1951, tells a similar story. He says, "When we caught illegal aliens on farms and ranches, the farmer or rancher would often call and complain to officials in El Paso. And depending on how politically connected they were, there would be political intervention. That is how we got into this mess we are in now." Bill Chambers, who worked for a combined 33 years for the Border Patrol and then called U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, says politically powerful people are still fueling the flow of illegals. During the 1950s, however, this good old boy system changed under Eisenhower, if only for about 10 years. In 1954, Ike appointed retired General Joseph Jumpin' Joe Swing, a former West Point classmate and veteran of the 101st Airborne, as the new INS commissioner. Influential politicians, including Senator Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas and Senator Pat McCarran of Nevada, favored open borders and were dead set against strong border enforcement, Brunell said. But General Swing's close connections to the president shielded him and the Border Patrol from meddling by powerful political and corporate interests. One of Swing's first decisive acts was to transfer certain entrenched immigration officials out of the border area to other regions of the country where their political connections with people such as Senator Johnson would have no effect. Then on June 17, 1954, what was called Operation Wetback began. Because political resistance was lower in California and Arizona, the roundup of aliens began there. Some 750 agents swept northward through agricultural areas with a goal of 1,000 apprehensions a day. By the end of July, over 50,000 aliens were caught in the two states. Another 488,000, fearing arrest, had fled the country. By mid-July, the crackdown extended northward into Utah, Nevada, and Idaho, and eastward to Texas. By September, 80,000 had been taken into custody. Skype user trying to call in. Okay, we've got a caller. I don't see that taking place. How do I bring him in, Kyle? Not sure. Oh, I see. Accept. Pajo Kernan. I'm going to add you to the group call. Okay, here we go.
Hi, Dick.
Hey, welcome to the show and the roundtable. And who are you?
My name's Padjo.
Padjo, welcome to the show.
Yeah. It's only just started, the show, so I know I'm calling in slightly early because I'm calling in from Britain. It's already like 5, what time is it, 4 in the morning or something. But, yeah, I just thought I'd... Obviously, you were looking for callers, so I thought I'd call in.
I appreciate that. It's kind of odd to do a roundtable by myself.
Of course.
I just did one of these type of roundtables the other day on my show, and I had 10 people participate all at one time. It was kind of cool. So over in England, I do talk with people over in England on a daily basis, and I do understand what's going on over there. So... could you share with the audience what you'd like to add to the show and what you'd like to talk about?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm just looking at the TV. I'm looking at this current thing with the Israelis beating up the Palestinian. That's not unusual, of course, but it's the fact that the media are running the story on a loop. And as we know, the media don't normally run anything that would go against the Zionist, propaganda. You know, they keep it sort of pro-Israel generally, don't they?
They do. They do.
So this is quite an interesting development, I think.
It's kind of connected to the ISIS thing, possibly. What do you think?
More than likely, yes, yeah. Of course, the ISIS thing, you know, it's hard to predict that because you can't help but think that that is, these are just one of these groups, basically to foment a revolution in the country and maybe keep the American troops there. So if they need to invade Iran at some point, they're in the the region, you know?
Yeah, and they could possibly just be like another Blackwater type of mercenary type of crew. Wouldn't you agree?
I'd say that's more than likely, to be honest. You know, we're seeing this pattern time and again through the last 100 years. It's, you know, like the Young Turks, you know.
Yes, over in Armenia.
Armenia, yeah.
The Hessians from the Rothschild mercenaries,
government.
I think, that were participating in the American Revolution, I believe.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Hey, Paj, we got another caller. Let's try to add another person to the discussion.
Oh, excellent.
All right. Hello, caller. We've got all ones, and welcome to the show. Who are you?
What's up, man?
What's going on?
Not much. I'm in Atlanta. Name is Naj.
Yeah. Okay. And what would you like to add to the show?
Well, honestly, I just checked in, so I was waiting to see where the conversation was going to see where to get in.
Right on, right on. Basically, in a nutshell, at first I was discussing kind of a chronological order of different opportunities or moments in time in American history in the past 100 years of trying to control or stop illegal immigration into this nation. Such as Operation Wetback and the Proposition 187 over in California, which tried to stipulate that anybody that was not a citizen would not be entitled to any benefits. So what are your thoughts on that concept?
Well, when I saw the title at first, I was wondering, I said, okay, is he trying to provoke people with the title? So you're saying that title comes from actual policy of
Dwight Eisenhower it was called Operation Wetback in 1954.
I see.
Yes. And it was successful. Yeah.
Well, this should be an interesting conversation.
Okay. And what particular race do you fit in, would you say?
Oh, I'm an African.
Okay. And your thoughts on the illegal immigration that's taking place in America, what are your thoughts on that? Has it prevented you from getting any jobs or higher wages, or has it been difficult to find work for yourself?
Well, not really work, but I don't think we can kind of look at something like that and just treat it as your own life if you really want to look at it. But I don't look at the end result of things. I look at the beginning. So if we're talking about illegal immigration, we got to talk NAFTA and GATT and some of these other trade policies that they've made over the last 20 years. And what you realize is if the American people could run across the border to Canada and make four times what they can make, then they would do the same thing. So my issue is not the illegals. My issue is big business and politicians pretty much colluding to bring low-wage labor to America. So how do we change that? That's how I look at the situation.
Sure, and that was part of Operation Wetback, where Eisenhower and some of the people that were in his circle realized that these big businesses were in cahoots with one another to increase their profits by having employees that were paid half or whatever amount than what the average American was making for that type of position and work. And with that Operation Wetback, what they did do was eliminate these Border Patrol agents that were working with big business they put them somewhere else so that people who are more honest and concerned about the nation actually enforced the border policy.
Yeah, I mean, just think about it. There's no death penalty type of fine for any business caught with somebody working who doesn't have, you know, the correct paperwork. That already lets you know that this is something that's kind of allowed with a wink and a nod. So my issue is when we talk about this, most of the time people spend talking about, you know, the end result. Oh, these people are here, they're doing this, they're doing that. And no matter what, my whole conversation starts with, okay, where does it start? How do we fix it at the start? The end result is the end result. That's way too far down the line to start fixing things there.
And Pajo, over in England, you've got a situation called the European Union, which also does that type or creates that type of scenario with even Europeans from different blocks coming over and actually working for a little less than what your native would actually earn. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. I mean, at first, initially, it was working for less, but of course, that then drags it down for everybody because that becomes, they call it the minimum wage.
Supply and demand comes into effect with that, too.
Yes, yes, it does. You know, and of course, you know, no country minds. It's nice having a rich tapestry, and it's nice having people come to visit your country. But it's not about that. There's an agenda of displacement in Europe. It's, you know, our situation is quite serious. You know, they say things like we're overpopulated, and then they move in, you know, sort of hundreds of thousands and millions of other people. It's part of this experiment. And I keep saying to people, Europe lost World War II. We lost World War II to Jewish imperialism. And part of the terms of our defeat now is to allow this multicultural project, mass immigration and all the rest of it. You know, and I like all races. I like all cultures. I actually have always fought to protect people's individual cultures and rights. But I find that when you talk about white people's rights in this regard, that it falls on deaf ears, you know. And, you know, I've had to take a slightly harder line in recent times because of this, you know, because I feel I'm opposing this Marxist, this Jewish imperialist thing that is going to end up bad for us all, you know. It really is. So,
agreed. And, Nas, do you agree that there's a Jewish issue involved?
Well, beyond that, of course, there's going to be, anytime you start talking about major banking, there's going to be, you know, some play in there. But the issue that he's talking about, I think that's a whole nother story, because you're talking about immigration into Europe, and that goes back to the colonial times, and the mother nations basically underdeveloped the nations that they colonized. Those nations became failed states, and everyone's whole idea of a good life was to go back to the mother country. So as every economist or any serious person will tell you, there is no free lunch. So if you exploit those countries for decades, at a certain point, you're going to get so many immigrants coming from that country that it's going to be a negative balance for you at a certain area. So there is no free lunch. All those colonies.
Just hold for one sec.
All of those colonies that England and France and these different countries that they had, at a certain point, you're going to have those people come back to your country, and they're going to come back unskilled and usually, you know, bringing down wages and things like that. But it's from your own doing. There is no free lunch. You can't have it both ways.
We're skipping over the Jewish issue.
and that's not the case of it anyway. I mean, you know, that's not the whole truth of it. This is an agenda because Europe lost the war. You know, Europe has lost it. The white people have lost their independence in this fight. You know, we have got a Jewish narrative completely, historical narrative, everything, even as far as slavery. You know, black slavery, American black, the slave trade. Yes. Look into that, you know. At the same time, we're inviting all these people into our countries, that we have a media telling them, propagandizing them, telling them that we are, the white man is evil, we caused all the trouble in the world. You know, that is proof in itself that we're not running things. You wouldn't invite people to your country and then propagandize them against us.
Exactly.
Well, I would say saying that the white man is evil being spread as some kind of propaganda is kind of nonsense. There are different levels of history, and there are also different levels of media. Of course, the media story is going to be one-sided and set to a certain way to raise emotion in people. So, I mean, if you think that's what they're promoting, I understand what you're saying, but as far as Jewish bankers and their involvement in slavery and their involvement in all of the major wars and their involvement in right now currency manipulation and things like that, yes, of course. I'm not discounting those things, but the major topic you were bringing up was immigration. And if you're talking about immigration from former colonies, that is the actual fact. I mean, I didn't make up anything about what I said.
Sorry, I missed that last sentence.
I said I didn't make up anything about what I've spoken about tonight. I mean, that's the reality. You're going to have those countries sending in thousands of people because they want to get away from the failed state that they live in.
Do they live in failed states? Are all these countries then incapable of running their own nations?
Look, we can do this the smart way or we can do this the emotional way. The emotional way is to say, stop blaming this person. The smart way is just as astute as you are about the Jewish influence in economics. You have to be about the colonial influence in colonies. They underdeveloped countries to fail. I don't think that's a radical idea. You haven't come to that assessment by looking at it?
No, but you're missing. I think you're underestimating the Jewish longevity. I mean, they've been basically controlling Britain for 300 years. Okay, and then all those revolutions that happened all those few hundred years ago across Europe was one by one them falling to the, you know, this sort of Freemasonic order, which just turns out to be the society protecting the banking system, right? And it has other elements. It's social engineering.
That's the huge point, though, right, that you said right there. There are other elements. There's that element that you said, that banking finance group who determines most of the direction of our lives across the world. But there's also other factors, like the factors that I just brought up. Now, if you want to dismiss those factors because they're not important to you, that's fine. But to say that they don't exist is nonsense.
Well, the fact that if you're saying that we colonized and it's kind of rightful retribution that now they're all coming here.
No, I'm not saying it's rightful retribution. What I'm saying is there is no free lunch. X leads to Y.
Yes.
If you do this, that's going to be the reaction to that. There is no thing of right or wrong in this. There is no morality in this. This is just dealing with the cold, hard facts.
But what I'm saying, my friend, is they're not just coming here.
I'll give you an example. Through NAFTA and GATT and these trade policies, we underdeveloped Mexico, ruined their whole farming economy, and crashed their job market. That caused a whole lot of Mexican immigrants to come over here illegally and lower our wages. So, like I said, there is no free lunch. The American people didn't vote for that policy. We were tricked into it. We don't want it to be like this. We want Mexico to be a sovereign country that can stand on its own. But
right.
I'm just saying that the blowback from those policies are going to affect the citizens, and you're going to have to deal with it. This is not a thing of playing the blame game. This is looking at what we are really facing and trying to figure out how we fix it. So right now,
go ahead. I was just going to say we're going to add one more person to the call. Hold on real quick. 424, welcome to the show.
Yeah, greetings. Great show tonight. Great discussion. How is everybody doing?
Doing well.
Good, man.
Thank you. And this is Don,
cool.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's me calling from behind the lines in Mexican-occupied California. And if your African caller there thinks there is no free lunch, he doesn't know very much about what's going on here behind the lines, because there's free lunches every day for illegal aliens that have across the border illegally, have invaded our country, and are stripping white American working people of the product of their labor and reducing white people to servitude because their own country is a failed disaster and has been a failed disaster for the last 300 years. America never colonized Mexico, nor Central America. And the idea that we are getting payback for something that we did in Mexico or Central America is simply ridiculous.
The first,
don't you know that you're
sir,
don't
sir,
you know
wait,
that you're
wait,
in
wait,
that
wait
plan
a minute,
right
wait,
now?
Wait, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Now, first of all, when we keep saying payback, as if I'm saying this like, okay, you did that, now you deserve this. No, I'm just talking about the logical conclusion and the logical reaction to what happens. Now, you say we didn't underdevelop Mexico. Do you know what NAFTA is?
Yeah, I know very well what NAFTA is. I also know that our first problem with illegal aliens was not Mexico and was not NAFTA. Our first problem with illegal aliens in the United States was in the early 1800s when freed blacks from Haiti, a black Republican, illegally migrated to New Orleans, which was a state under the control. It was the United States territory where slavery was legal. Free blacks from Haiti left Haiti where slavery had been outlawed and came to the white United States where slavery was legal for a better life because they felt they had an opportunity for a better life in a society that was controlled and managed by white people. And this is exactly what you're seeing today with the illegal alien invasion of the United States. Non-white people from all over the world are coming here for the better life they have never been able to create in their own lands. And when white people disappear in the United States, as they are rapidly, as they've almost completely disappeared from the metropolitan Los Angeles, that better life will disappear with them, and it will disappear forever. And some of these illegal alien communists out here are saying that European people ought to go back to Europe. Well, you know, if we did that, they would be hot on our heels to follow us to our European ancestral homeland for the better life there that would suddenly disappear here. When Mexicans come to California, they transform California into Mexico. And then they run away from that and fan out across the rest of the country looking for nice white communities to move into and transform into Mexican slums.
Okay. I guess we can get into the things to where, okay, you said the free Haitians came to the United States where the law of the land was slavery. In actual truth, the people who came to America from Haiti were the people who were former landowners and usually sons and daughters of the former slave masters. That's why you have the Creole, the so many mulatto, and so many different tones and different ethnic backgrounds in New Orleans, because those were the mixed children who came over here, not the freedom-fighting Haitians who kicked the French out. So that's a historical misstep
you took
right there.
In 1809, 3,100 free blacks illegally came into New Orleans, what was then the Louisiana Territory, and they were trying to pass laws to stop it because they believed that the free blacks would be a problem. It would be difficult to find jobs for them in a constricted labor market, and they believed they would be a source of insurrection. Remember that in 1804, the Haitian government, after achieving independence, massacred every single white person they could find on the island of Haiti, and the white people in New Orleans were necessarily a little concerned about their presence in that city and in that territory.
Again, you mixed it up again. The freedom fighters
were
the people.
I haven't mixed up anything.
No, you did. The freedom fighters were the people.
Why would you call them freedom fighters? They massacred
door to door. They had their own land, and people came and oppressed them, and they killed them and got them out of there. I would support anybody who fights for their own land. Nothing wrong with that at all. Now, like I said, the immigrants from Haiti who came to America were not those people. Those were the sons and daughters of usually the French generals, the French businessmen, the French landowners, and those people. They wanted to leave because they didn't have those advantages anymore. Interesting story, if you want to read Rochambeau's incident, that'll give you a good insight into how big the divide was between the mulattoes and the original black Haitians there. So no, there's a huge difference in that story.
Yeah,
and,
I'm aware of the racial divide in Haiti. I'm also aware that of the 465 black slaves, one third of them were owned by free blacks. There's a very good book called Revolution, Romanticism, and the African Creole Protest and Tradition in Louisiana by a college professor named Karen Koss Bell, and she talks about the illegal alien problem and how the migration of free slaves, the voluntary coming into this country of free black slaves, was a huge problem for that territory in the early 1800s.
Well, that would be a huge problem for any territory. If you create a system that's set for 50,000 people, if you add 10,000 or whatever number you want to say more people to that situation, it's going to be problematic. But once again, those were not the free men or the revolutionaries who fought for their freedom. Those were the people who were looking for a way out of Haiti because they did not like the new set of circumstances. They didn't have the
advantages. Well, they didn't
want
to live under a black government? They didn't like the new set of circumstances under a black government that had abolished slavery,
because
so
they
came to a white government where slavery was legal.
No, because they had the favors. Well, I just want to make sure we're truthful tonight. Well, they were the people who had French blood, and they had certain favors and certain advantages before the revolution. So after the revolution and they lost those advantages and they would have to go back to square one, they decided to leave instead. So no, it's not the same thing.
So these were what, black race traders?
Well, I don't know if you can necessarily call them race traders, because these are people born with French blood in Haiti and they're born with those advantages. What person would take advantage of
those? I studied this issue very, very intensively, and the people were freed blacks. They weren't freed French. They were freed blacks. And in 1809, more than 3,100 of them came into Louisiana. And do you not think there was a measure of irony in the fact that free blacks free a black country where slavery was abolished so that they can seek a better life in a white country where slavery is still legal?
Okay, so now I see what we're dealing with here. You have an idea that no matter what, a black state will be a failed state and a white state will be better, so you're trying to use this story to fit your narrative, but it doesn't fit.
Well, I don't know.
Well, just hold on.
Tell me how many blacks you've heard of who went to Haiti for a better life.
Well, actually, during that time, there were a lot of them, because Haiti was the only free democratic nation in the world at the time. They actually were responsible for arming a whole lot of
them. Where did they come from?
Where did the artists come
from?
I've never heard that one before.
If you're going to interrupt me with one question with another, I mean, we can have a conversational tone. No need to get aggressive. It'll be okay.
What was the point of departure for all of these free blacks who went to Haiti?
Well, I explained it twice, but you feel like you know it better. So, I mean, hey,
well, I
didn't
know
how you
feel because I read the history of it.
No, you don't. You've read one version of history that is nowhere near the truth. And that's where the issue lies. These were mulatto, French-blooded Haitians who did not like the new set of circumstances because they lost all of their advantages, which they previously used against the other people, which pretty much was a big starter for the whole revolution to begin with. So they decided to leave. That has nothing to do with black or white or anything like that. It's just people saying, okay, things have changed here. We're not on top anymore. Let's get out of here. I mean, it's a simple thing.
All right. We got another caller, 240. 240, welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. I was finding this conversation interesting. I entered into it late.
All right, Tom Bowie, welcome to the show.
Yes, sir.
Indeed. Welcome, sir.
And what would you like to add to this conversation?
I find that the different perspectives on history never meet between honest white men and honest black men, but at least they're honest perspectives.
Good point. And usually the truth lies in the middle, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, it depends on what research you're using. If one person is using research to kind of prop up an idea or something that has been debunked, and the other person is using the best that they can, and, hey, It is what it is, man. I'm not going to argue the point of the Haitians coming over to America, because that did happen. But the idea that the Haitians who fought in the revolution came over to America, that's absurd.
Okay, so we've got another caller, 219. 219, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, and who's
going on?
Okay, all I can say is this person that's been on the forum wasting the last 40 minutes with his black studies nonsense. Prime example, why never to import cheap labor. Cheap foreign labor. Should have been done. It happened. That's the dead past. We're living in the present day. What are we going to do with these haywire orphans of Abraham Lincoln? And that's all I got to say.
Well, the man made a statement. If you guys feel like I'm kind of interrupting your conversation with a different perspective and you don't want me here, that's fine. I'll take that. But if you want to continue, we can. Makes no difference to me.
Okay, we've got a call, 307. 307, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. I know there's been people in the past who've tried to work with black folks against the ruling class, but that's never worked out. I mean, it's never worked. But why do you think that is?
Are you asking me or the panel?
Well,
who are you asking? Anybody's free to answer that.
Yeah, well, okay, I'll take it. That's not a simple question of black and white. That's just a simple question of when do my advantages come and when do I decide that this whole alliance is not worth keeping. So if you were a populist farmer in America way back in the day and you were working with black farmers, at a certain point, if they were not, you know, really helping you in the situation because of their race being a huge factor in hurting you, then you might decide, hey, we're going to part ways right here because right now you can't really help us in this situation. And I think every partnership kind of has those kind of, that kind of fork in the road at some point. We're not doing anything together at this point. We've gotten as far as we can, so we need to split and go our separate ways. It really has nothing to do with race. It's just people looking at the landscape and deciding, look, our way is this way, so we're going over there.
Still think race is a huge factor, especially in a multicultural area where it used to be a 90% white country.
I tend to draw a parallel in why it doesn't work with World War II and the Allies. The Allies didn't really get along other than at the very top. As Patton said, if the Russians were on one side and the Germans on the other side, he'd attack in both directions. So they could fight a common foe, just not together.
Indeed. Okay. Indeed.
Good point. Don, would you like to tune in?
I'm sorry, what was that again? I was distracted there for a minute.
Oh, not a problem. I just thought that you might have had something to add to what Don just had to say.
And, about Patton and fighting the Russians? Yeah, I agree with Patton that we should have attacked the Russians. But I think the bigger point is we should not have been involved in World War II at all, not in any manner.
Oh, agreed.
If we went in at all, we should have gone on the side of the Germans, actually. We should not have bailed out the British for the second. We should not have bailed out the British Empire for the second time in less than half a century, and that was all that was achieved by the American involvement in World War One. We not only bailed out the British Empire in the aftermath of World War One, the British Empire added 1 million square miles of new territory, and as David Lloyd George said of Woodrow Wilson, he left Paris with a pocket full of assignats. assignats for the worthless French currency of the French Revolution. We lost 116,000 men in that war, and we got nothing, absolutely nothing, in return. The British Empire was significantly increased and significantly bolstered, although in the final analysis the British could not occupy and govern what they conquered and what they achieved by that war.
Yeah, well, can I ask two questions? Okay, realizing that after World War II we would take over from Britain as far as all of those different possessions and also the idea of the number one world power. And then the second thing being, knowing that the Japanese had no real oil production and would have needed some of those islands over there in East Asia, I mean, it was inevitable that we would have had to get into the war at a certain point. Japan was not going to operate their war machine with no oil. So, I mean, I don't think it could have been avoided.
Those sanctions were put on Japan by America and mostly Jews.
Well,
any major power would, though. What major power would allow them to, you know what I mean, to get those possessions?
Well, they took the possessions because we had an oil embargo and we froze their assets in this country. And Roosevelt actually, prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, was planning a surprise air raid on mainland Japan. It was planned. It was going to be handled by four-engine bombers flown by American crews with nationalist Chinese markings. This plan had already been approved and was already well underway. But just because of the fluke of history, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor first. Interestingly enough, under the George W. Bush doctrine of preemptive warfare, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor would have been fully justified. Kind of an interesting historical irony there.
Yeah. Yeah, good point, good point.
So anybody else want to tune in? We've got five callers.
Yeah, well, this is Padjo. I would just say, you know, the whole thing is agenda of Jewish imperialism. It's just absolutely so blatantly obvious, right?
Yeah.
That it's about the rise of communism, and you're right, Patton was right. Of course, he could see the trick by the end of the war. You could see that what they were doing is smashing, basically, white European resistance to this new agenda of internationalism, globalism, or communism. And what we have now is communism light. We've got it, you know, with all these cultural Marxist agendas, like the gay and lesbian thing, with women's rights. You've got rights this, rights that. And, of course, the multiculturalism thing and all the propagandization on the televisions, you know. So this is what new communism's like. Even when you watch football on TV now, they're using political slogans. Say no to racism. And we know when they're talking about racism, they're only talking about white people. No one else is ever accused of racism. This is a way of getting white people to hand over their countries out of some kind of guilt, you know.
Good point.
Can we get into some definitions here, sir? The gentleman from England. Can you practice racism, sir?
Can I what?
Could you practice racism yourself as a regular UK citizen?
Can you practice? How do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the definition is so skewed now, and it's thrown around so much that people don't understand what it actually is. To be a racist requires some kind of power, some kind of control. If you can stop people from getting jobs or stop them from living in places or can, you know, deprive them of something, you can be a racist. If you're a regular working class citizen, then the most you could be is possibly a bigot. You don't like other races. But if you don't have the power or control, then you can't be racist. So when they say these things about racism, all they're doing is kind of substituting the word bigotry for racism. It just leads to us with empty meanings. It doesn't mean anything.
It's about, look, man, it's about statistics, isn't it? They just projected that in Britain by the year 2050, a third of the whole island is going to be non-white. Now, that's as blatant as can be. We're talking about displacement. We're talking about an attack on our ancestral homelands. So me opposing that is not racist, is it? It's just a nonsensical term.
As I said, man, if people replace bigotry a lot of times instead of racism and these different little arguments they have, we'd be a lot better off because people would understand what we're talking about. But most people don't have the power to pull that off, so people accusing them of being racist are flawed in their whole critique of it. But like I said before, man, there is no free lunch. Y'all going to get those colonial peoples coming to your country. I'm sorry, brother, but that's what it is.
But you see, so you think it's perfectly fine for blacks to have ethnic interests?
I'm not making any assertion about anything being morally good, perfectly fine, or anything like that. All I'm saying is this leads to that. That's all I'm saying. No emotion in this.
There's a point being brought up in the chat room called critical race theory, which is taught in most schools and mostly in black churches. What do you have to say about critical race theory?
I can promise you it's not taught in black churches, but in black colleges, or if you take African American studies, yeah, they do teach that. That is true.
Okay.
Black churches? No. They don't teach anything.
Master Wong?
Yes, go ahead.
This critical race theory, I mean, the people who benefit most from that is the capitalists. I mean, it's the money people at the top. It's not really a communist that benefits from that, is there?
Hey, I'm not a guy out here provoking any type of race theory. I'm a black nationalist, if anything. I'm a guy who says black people should have their own and control their own. I'm not for any idea of coming to other people and asking them for a job or asking them to be included in what they do. That's not my thing.
Well, I mean, it's cited as a example of communism, a communist agenda, but I mean, if anybody's benefiting off that stuff, it's the people at the top. I mean, I don't really see a communist.
Okay.
Well, I'll put it like this. For the most part, when you start talking about political correctness and things like that, those are for the people at the top, as you just said, because basically they give them an outline of what they can and can't say and what will be bad for business and what will get you fired. They don't really care about racial conditions or race relations. All they care about is, okay, we have a set idea of what you can and can't say. If you mess up, then you're a rogue employee who went off script and you're fired, but the corporation won't lose any footing in the marketplace. So, I mean, that's who it's for. I mean, going back to your point, it's for the people at the top.
The environment.
The people at
who
the top through mass media. Yeah, people at the top
media.
Through mass
exactly.
media, of course.
And who controls that?
Ah, here we go. Back to the Jews again.
Well, there's a Jewish segment.
There's an Anglo-Saxon segment. There's even a smaller black and Asian segment now. There's a Latino segment now when you look at Univision and some of the things they promote on the Spanish channels you see in America and other places now. So, I mean, there are different groups of the elite. Now, if you want to talk about that top of the top, I think you guys know where we're going to go with that. You hit it on the head.
All right, we got another caller, 661. 661, welcome to the show.
Hello, Renegades.
Hello Frank.
African-American. Hey, how you doing?
Well,
I would say this. Good show there, swirling into action. The problem, I think, with the African-American caller's tit-for-tat attitude is the fact that most white people throughout history have been non-colonialists and non-slave owners. Now, I can prove this very quickly and succinctly. I'll take myself as an example. I could go up to any African-American person and clearly demonstrate that there's much more of a chance that his ancestors owned slaves than mine did. My ancestors hail from Eastern Europe. There was zero history of slavery. Whereas in Africa, it is still rampant in the tribes. I recently saw a rerun of a 2020 episode where they were actually in the interior of Africa with their cameras and microphones and actually talking to real African slave owners and their slaves. This is today, right now. Nobody is the least bit concerned. So I can make the conclusion that most African Americans do not have a problem with slavery. They just have a problem with white people.
Well, I mean, if we're going to have conversations like this, let's put everything out there. Let's not throw shots and hide. Now, if you want to talk about African slavery now...
Who's hiding?
Well, okay, we'll get into it. If you want to talk about African slavery now, there are multiple organizations and groups out there fighting against it. And if you want to talk about slavery historically, the Arab slave trade was actually before the European slave trade. We've been fighting them for much, much longer, and we actually had to go into cahoots with them to get the Romans out of Africa, and then in turn, we couldn't get the Muslims or Arabs off of our back afterwards.
Ah, you know, you're bringing up some good points. I agree
Well, just let me finish. Hang on one second. I really
don't have a lot of time here. I'm enjoying your contributions, but I don't have a lot of time, so I just want to throw this in, if I might. According to Dinesh D'Souza, an Indian gentleman, he is not white. You can Google this as well, and this is in his recent book. All, like you say, all races have participated in slavery throughout history, but the unique thing about the white race is it is the only race that has ended it amongst its own kind, the only race that has fought itself numerous times throughout history to free members of other races. That is our unique epithet, sir. That is what sets us apart. Not as colonialists and slave masters. That is something that belongs to all of humanity. What sets us apart is that we rose above that.
Are you finished?
Thank you.
Sure.
Go ahead, first thing first,
chattel slavery is a thing that's only unique to the European. So their version of slavery was
what?
Actually, yeah, their no, version.
No, no, read the
just,
Old
just,
Testament.
Just
no,
hold on.
No,
hold
no,
on.
I can't let that. Hey,
well, first
I can't
of all,
let
you tried
go.
To use
that's bullshit.
You tried to use Dinesh D'Souza as a source when he's nothing but a provocateur.
Look it up, you motherfucker. I didn't try anything. Listen to me, you dumb son of a bitch.
Oh, listen to this.
You just
listen
said
to this
something
intelligent discourse.
You
what
just
else you
said
got?
Something that's patently false.
No,
well,
no, you actually
in
did
now.
In four of your statements.
You read the Old
Testament,
and now
you're trying to outshout me so I can't
hey,
refute
Nick,
your punch.
Hey, Nick, shut this fuck head up?
Listen,
you guys are talking
here.
Over one
listen
another.
To
so.
That. Are we adults?
Because he said something patently false, so I'm
Frank,
stepping
I muted,
in.
Frank, I muted Chad so you can finish your statement, and I'll bring Chad back on.
The bottom
ahead,
line is this. He just said, I was all prepared to sit there and listen. It took him about 5 seconds to serve up a Whopper with extra cheese on it. That chattel slavery is unique to the European people. These kind of things cannot go uncontested. Let him read the Old Testament, where in many, many places, and he can Google them up, the exact chapters and verses, where Yahweh orders his chosen pets to murder all the Amalekites, etc., but to take the young women as slaves that they may keep forever. That is chattel slavery. Also, what occurs in Africa is chattel slavery. This is nonsense. Sitting here politely, letting him serve up an extra Whopper with cheese, okay? And that cheese is rancid. I was prepared to listen and let him finish. It's a Whopper of a nonsensical statement. Sorry. But like I said, guys, I don't have a lot of time here. So I'm going to roll and let him continue to bullshit, and you guys have a great roundtable.
Thank you, Frank. And
nice one, Frank.
And Chad will be brought back on. Does anybody want to add anything before I bring Chad back on? Anyone?
Hello?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, well, I've got to say, I've been listening to Renegade for a good few months now, and I really like Frank. I think Frank's got a great way of putting things.
Exactly. Anyone else?
There was some sort of scientific type study that came out a few months ago that said that whites specifically were born racist. They had a racist gene that was specific to whites. I don't know if that. It was a study out of the left. It was an indictment, you know, to reinforce the whites that they were specifically evil. But I mean, I would think that seems to make sense to me. I think maybe whites are born different with some type of gene that they're born racist. I mean, I think that has played into history in some way. I don't really know how or where, but I mean.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, I'm going to bring Chad back on. Welcome back, Chad. I just wanted to not have any interruptions. Go ahead, buddy.
Well, what the man just brought up was junk science. There is no race of people who are genetically set to be racist or anything like that. What we're talking about is culture. And if you come from a culture to where things are harder and, it's more aggressive because of the scarcity of resources, then you're going to take that same mind frame when you meet other people. If you come from a more abundant area, then you won't be as warlike. So that's a cultural thing and a location thing. It's not a thing of any kind of genetic destination. The guy before, he asked me questions, and then as I responded, he started cursing and yelling in order to interrupt me because he doesn't want anyone to disturb the thoughts that he's already decided are the truth. That's fine for children, but it's a bad thing for adults. As an adult, when you get new information, you take it, weigh it out, research it, and if it's good, use it. If it's not, throw it away. But the idea that you think that you have to start, throwing out words and saying this person is that and that, that's nonsense. We're all grown, man. We can do better than
that.
You know
what's always made me laugh is this idea that white people would go over to Africa and just be able to round up all these Africans as slaves. We know damn fine that the Africans had a perfectly functioning slave trade when they got there. It was just a trade thing. The whole world was doing it. It's not like a bunch of white guys just went and just, bullied all these big, strong black guys, is it? Onto a ship.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make when he cut me off. Well, that was the point I was trying to make when he cut me off. Right. There's different forms. One form was you were a slave for a certain period of time. You actually were able to have a family. You actually had your own home. It's a different type of slave than someone who's involved in chattel slavery. I was just bringing up the difference. That's not an indictment of white people. That's just stating a historical fact. There's nothing wrong with stating historical facts. We can't be that sensitive.
You do admit black people were involved in slavery then?
As I said, there's a huge difference between the two, though. That's the big qualifier that you have to add in there. You can't just simply say, well, they had slavery too, because the two forms of slavery were so totally different. We're talking about the European age of not only banking and mercantilism. This was an age of figuring out things by the numbers. So their whole trade was, we can pack 1,000 people on this ship and possibly 700 will survive. Okay, that's a good route. Let's take it. So it's a totally different thing from somebody being a slave to another family, but also having his own life. And that's the point I was trying to make. Now, like I said, the Arab slave trade started before the white one and is actually still going on to this day and is being fought daily. And hopefully we can rid ourselves of that scourge. But I'm not here to just sit up and bash the white man. Now, if you want to bring up the truth of history and talk about the white man or black man, whoever, I'm not scared to state anyone's truth about what they've done.
Well, this slave trade, I think this deal with Russia was over, wheat or corn. America turns wheat and corn into ethanol when we put it in our cars and trucks. And, Americans like big cars and trucks. So, I mean, you can call it a lot of things, but I mean, there's a worldwide. I mean, it's just the way things are. There's a huge population surge, and there's a huge food shortage. At the same time, you have America, you know, is turning food into fuel for, you know, large cars. I mean, I don't know that you can say anything's really progressing. I mean, people think it's progressing, but that's not reality.
Yeah. And the sad reality is every empire falls. So, I mean, we probably got 150 more years maybe or something, you know, some large number in that arena. But, I mean, America will fall just like every other empire who was on top will fall. Nobody stays on top forever. The African civilizations who started off first, they were on top at one point. But those who are first, of course, you're going to fall first. And when they fell, it was probably the worst time to ever fall because you had the Arab civilization springing up. You had Europe seeing a new age of technology and thinking and weaponry. So they just fell at the wrong time, and now we have Africa the way it is to this day. But I don't knock anybody by what they were born. Nobody chose to be a white man, black man, Arab, or anything else. You were born into this world, and you pretty much go after that. And when people take so much pride in their ethnicity, it makes me question them because you didn't do anything to earn it. That's just the way you were born. Be prideful
of something
you've done.
It sounds like a George Carlin phrase. I want to read something that was typed to me.
Yeah.
Here's what Blutton Bowden has to say. He cannot call in, so here's his comment. It is not logical or historical that those peoples from lands that have previously been colonized end up in the land of those who colonized them. The argument that they want to come here because their countries have been destroyed due to colonization is preposterous, simply due to the fact that these nations are more advanced now than they were prior to colonization. That is, if we focus solely on base materialism, as Marxists love to do. However, even if we address this argument under the paradigm that, yes, they want to come here because we destroyed their lands from a purely materialistic perspective, the fact remains their wanting to come here is irrelevant to them actually making it here, white lands. The issue is how they are able to come here. They are able to come here because of over a millennia of Christ insanity culminating in the so-called Enlightenment, which merely secularized the morality of Christ's retardation and has allowed for the kikes to subvert and take advantage of our now suicidal and pathological altruism.
That's interesting. I think he's missing a huge point there in his assessment, though. When you talk about these colonial countries, the managerial class or the upper and wealthy class of those countries, those people, they're taught by the mother country, and they're taught to manage for the mother country. They're not taught to create and really build. They don't have the skills or the talent. So what do they learn? Okay, I'm going to vacation every year back in the home country, come back and tell everyone how great it is, and we're going to continue to export our resources to the home country. So the country never develops because their class of people who should be organizing and managing aren't qualified to do so. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a whole class of people who are in positions of power, but their whole power is based on their relationship with the home country. And once you have that, man, you got a failed state because you can't govern.
How did the American colonists succeed so well after their revolution? They were colonized by Great Britain. Presumably they were governed by people whose job was to manage for the colonial power. How is it that we were such a success and achieved an independent country while all the others seem to have failed?
Yeah, two things.
Why was the United States so successful and Haiti such a failure? They achieved independence at approximately the same time.
Well, those are really big questions. The American story, the Revolutionary War, which we won, and then the idea of expansion. So this wasn't just a set country to where these 13 colonies and then there's a coastline, that's it. No, you had a huge area of land to explore, to populate, and to produce goods. So, I mean, nobody else has ever had that opportunity to where your country grew to the size of what America grew to. To compare
well,
to the Haiti,
the Indians who were here had that opportunity because they had North America for 10,000 years. Why didn't they succeed with it?
Well, they did succeed. They were doing fine. They just lost to a better army. They were doing fine.
They were doing fine. Tell me about their space program.
Who had a space program at that time, sir?
Well, white people had the ability to master shipbuilding and navigation skills and sail around the world, and ultimately that became a space program. But there was a huge disparity in the 1500s between the achievements and capabilities of white Europeans and people in the rest of the world. So I mean, England is a tiny island. How did England, with its tiny little island, how did the English people achieve mastery of so much of the rest of the world when their little island was so tiny?
Well, a technological advantage as far as guns, and then the advantage of people didn't know what country they were coming from. When they came over and told people the greatness of England, these other countries assumed this was some great big country and great big power that was coming over there conquering them. So, I mean, with that and astute management, they were able to, conquer the majority of the world. So, I mean, that was a great game plan by England. But when you talk about the Native Americans and their civilization saying, why weren't they as advanced? Because every culture has their time. Cultures are going to fall. As great as Egypt was, as great as Greece was, as great as Rome was, they all fell. And once a country like that falls, the fallout from that is, then you just got tribes roaming. And any organized or really set army can come in and conquer them. There's really no fight. So, I mean, I don't think we can call the Native Americans a failed state. They did a good job.
They didn't have a state to begin with. Isn't that correct?
They had tribes of nations. They actually, we actually based some of the, I believe it was the Constitution, off of one of those pacts that those tribes held with each other, to where they kind of met up every year for some kind of group meeting and decided law and things like that. So, I mean, Native Americans came along with
it. Indians, which of the Indian tribes had a written language?
You'd have to talk to somebody who knows a lot more about Native American culture than me on that one.
I know something of that. None of them had a written language. The Hawaiians didn't have a written language. The Aztecs came close, but not really. So when you say we plagiarized some Indian document, I would ask you, in what language was that document written, and by whom was it written? Because there's no record of it in history.
I think it actually is. That would take a little bit of time on the whole Google function here, but shouldn't take me too long. So while we're having this conversation, I'll take a look into it and see what I can find. If I'm proven wrong, I will fully admit it, sir.
I also understand that the Mayan culture at one point was thriving until it became multicultural. So it goes back to the whole homogenous society versus a bag of mixed race, as far as the comfortness, the ability to have a homogenous society versus a multicultural one.
Well, didn't the Mayans have the pyramids? Isn't it the Mayan civilization that has those pyramid shapes?
You can call them pyramids, but it's nowhere near like in Egypt. But we'll just put it like this. The Great Pyramid of Giza is 2 million one-ton blocks. Like, their pyramids are pretty big, but it's totally different. And I think it was more for religious ceremony than anything.
Yeah, I think, in this conversation I'm hearing, it's the British, it's the French, it's the blah, blah. I think we're missing out the whole system of control, which has gone from, we've seen it with the Vatican, the control of Rome over Europe. This secret control never went away. You see, and things like colonialism, you'll say it's the British. How could a tiny island and a tiny country like England have this much power? But it's just that was the headquarters for this system, like Amsterdam was the headquarters before. And you're talking about the fall of America. Well, the fall of America is happening right in front of our eyes, and we know exactly why it's falling and how it's falling. The fact is, do we have the power to stop it? Because if we don't, basically that's the end of it for a European man. We're not allowed to have our own country anymore, are we? So that's what it's about. So we're seeing it right before our eyes playing out. And this black guy, he knows well that it's looking good for the black community as far as it goes, because...
Looking good for the black community?
Just inheriting...
Where?
Our technology and all the rest of it. I mean, you're just, Man, I've got nothing against black people, you know, but there is an agenda going on quite clearly, and it's very anti-white. And you've got to at least admit that much.
Well, I want to know where it's looking good for the black people. because I try to find it, and I don't see that, man. I don't see that.
Chad, isn't Atlanta thriving right now as far as being a mostly black area?
Well, Atlanta is doing pretty well, but, I mean, are we going to extrapolate that across the country and see if it,
compares to
other cities? No.
Sure, so. But wouldn't you agree that Detroit had its opportunity to have a black community and a black nation, per se, and it failed?
No, not at all. The black people in Detroit didn't control anything or own anything. The black people of Detroit were simply citizens who were there. They didn't own anything. The people who moved out to Grand Rapids and Auburn Hills and, you know, the people who had most of those jobs working on cars and things like that, those are the people who determined what Detroit became because they decided to move out along with their tax dollars. Nothing replaced it, and now Detroit is Detroit. And this won't be the only city that that happens to.
Well, I can tell you that the black community isn't doing very well behind the lines of Mexican-occupied California because the Mexicans are shooting them and driving them out of town.
Well, the white community's not doing well. The black community's not doing well. I don't think anybody is except the Arab class who comes over here with a little money. If you look up Dearborn, Michigan, they're thriving while Detroit is falling. So,
Dearborn is thriving?
Excuse me?
Did you just say the Arabs? The Arabs are the only ones that are benefiting.
The Arabs in Dearborn, Michigan. I was talking
about
the
Arabs over in the suburbs
because
it's close
to Detroit.
Doing pretty well. Yeah, the Arabs over in the Detroit suburbs are doing pretty well, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
I would agree about the Arabs. They seem to do pretty well buying and selling to dumb Americans. The one time
here it is. This was the Great Law of Peace. It was an oral constitution, the Iroquois Confederacy, and this influenced the United States Constitution.
In which language
look it
was
up
it
yourself.
Written?
I just
in which
told you it was an oral constitution made by six nations, Oneida, Mohawk, Sagaya, Seneca, Tarakora, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the other one, but yeah. You can look it up tonight. I just Googled it now after you asked me the question.
Yeah, I know they had tribes and I know they had alliances.
Right.
I know they had treaties. I had never thought they had a written language or written documents. And you, by you saying they had an oral constitution,
mm-hmm.
since it was oral, how do we know what it said?
Well, we know what it said because of historians like Donald Grind of University at Buffalo. And also from the work of Benjamin Franklin and James Madison. They also admitted to that. So, look it up yourself. If you think I'm wrong, feel free.
Well,
I'm not here to get agreement.
Did any of those sources say, well, you said it was an oral constitution, so somebody obviously related it orally and that it was translated into English.
There we go.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. I don't have the real facts on it. I just have this small outline on it. But, yeah, that's what it looks like from here. But, yeah, I don't understand the idea of trying to compare different civilizations because everybody has their time and place. And, like I said, man, it doesn't matter. Greater ones than us have failed. So we're going to fall eventually, of course, but it's our job to try to slow that decline and try to keep it as long as we can. But I'm not one of the people who goes around saying the sky is falling and all of that, man. We've seen much worse. You know what I mean? We've had darker hours. We had a day when the White House was burned down. Okay, so look, we've had worse than right now.
As far as European survival is concerned, I mean, the sooner this system goes under, the better. I mean, it's not. The slow grind is the most dangerous thing. It's far worse than a fall.
Hey, the white historian, I added white just for you guys, Dan Carlin, amateur historian admitted, but still a great mind. He makes a statement that when you're in an empire and it's starting to decline, that's probably the most exciting time to live in because you get to see so many different things happen, so many different factors kind of showing you how a society declines and how you can try to prop it up, because everybody who went through this tried to fix it as best they could. You know what I mean? So how much longer can we extend it? Or can we have a rebirth and start over? Who knows? This is the exciting time. You just don't want to be there at the very end. That's where you don't want to be there.
I would argue that to speed it up is of greater benefit, because currently there are at least some people with skills that are no longer practiced in the modern world, and would speed its recovery as opposed to dragging it out long enough for those skills to be lost.
Yeah, that same radio host makes the statement that if everything failed today, all that fiber optic cable that we've run all over the country for the internet, for, you know, for what we're doing right now on a talk show on the internet, people would pull that up for rope because it would be a different day, a different time. When those European powers started to become civilizations and they looked around at the infrastructure that Rome left, the things they were using, you know, those things for were for practical reasons. They might tear down a temple just for the stone. You know what I mean? So, yeah, things change, man, after something falls. And the needs are different. So it's who knows what the hell we would do with some of these buildings we have now.
Good point. Hey, we've got another call. David, welcome to the show.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. And where are you calling from?
I'm actually calling from England as well.
Welcome. What would you like to add to the conversation?
One of the most interesting debates I've heard this evening of the show. What's the black guy's name?
Chad.
Chad, Chad, I have a couple of questions for you and a couple of points I'd like to hear your point of view on. Well, where do I start? Firstly, from a European point of view, I know you're going about colonialism. My answer to that would just be following the route of the money. The ships, who funded those ships? Yeah. Amsterdam, New York being changed from New Amsterdam to New York. The handover, the framing of it all. It's happened throughout history. The Portuguese gave up land. The Dutch gave up land in the end. Then it became the British. Now, they may all look European and white to you. But a lot of these people claim to be Semites, and that's happened throughout history. They seem to be involved in it deeply, at all levels. And they want nothing more than us lot arguing amongst ourselves, both our races. And I would also like to ask you what your opinion on white privilege is, and if you're aware of who was running the white privilege problem.
Good point.
Thank you.
The last part, can somebody give me a little clarity on it? I couldn't hear him well.
He wanted to he asked, who is running this white privilege conference? Who's behind that?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know anything about a white privilege conference. I do know that that word has or that phrase has a lot of traction right now. So people are picking up on it. People are using it on social media and things like that. And as we talked about earlier when we used the word racism, if you don't get the proper definition, then before you know it, people are misusing it, and you're applying white privilege to regular white folk. And regular white folk don't have the same privileges as that upper-class group of people who the critique was about. So, it becomes a little problematic when you tell the guy you're working a shift with that he has white privilege, when you're working the same job, live in the same conditions, eat the same level of food. So that becomes a problem as well. But white privilege does exist. I think we all know that.
It does. No, we don't all know that. I see that seems to me to be bizarre that you would even mention that in that respect. I live in a country, and I was born in 1979, far away from any form of slavery. As far as I'm aware, from my history, when my king was killed in the 1600s, we were given a Jewish empire that ruled the world, and my country has taken the blame for that ever since. It's now to the point where my country is now invaded with foreigners, to the point where European white people are being bred out of existence. To me, that seems worrying. To say that there's white privilege, to me, is farcical. You know, it seems to me like you don't want to mention the Jews in this in any way. It just annoys me.
No, it's not at all. I'm not trying to protect them in any way either. No, I just think, okay, you say your power, the power in your country was usurped by a Jewish banking, you know, conglomerate, you could say.
Would you look into Cornwall for us?
Well,
Chad,
I'm not arguing against that. I was trying to make the point of that that doesn't mean that Englishmen didn't go out and fight those wars. Those were English-blooded men who went out and fought those wars. Now, saying that they were manipulated to fight some of those wars, I will agree with that 100%. But we can't act like they didn't participate. Just like
African Americans participate in the U.S. military today?
There we go. There's a huge number, and always has been a huge number. So we're culpable in that situation.
This ruling class that let the Jews in, I mean, they were well aware of what they were doing. I mean, they weren't deluded. I mean, you say the masses are deluded, but I don't think the ruling class is.
Right. I agree with that. Right. The masses
propaganda
are deluded,
is a powerful tool.
Indeed.
Propaganda.
Indeed.
All right, so we've got another caller, 661. 661, sorry for keeping you on hold so long. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
661, are you ready to talk?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. And what's your name?
Oh, it's George.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good.
All right, we can barely hear you, man. What would you like to add to this conversation? We've got a roundtable going on, and I don't want to disrupt it with your audio issues.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man.
All right, you don't know? Thank you. He's muted. Anybody can go ahead. He never knows what he wants to say whenever he calls in, so go ahead. Hey, Don, I haven't heard from you in a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just kind of listening. No particular comment to make.
Okay. Tom Bowie, I haven't heard from you in a while.
Yeah, we have a overly complex caste system that is always operated beneath the surface to some extent. Mm-hmm. Our white elite don't think they're related to us in any way.
Yep.
And they're happy to sell us down the river. They'll shout white privilege and then turn around and point at somebody as the one who has white privilege, who has no power whatsoever, but never at themselves.
Thank you, sir. That was the point I was trying to make.
Because they don't, well, they're basically, to some extent, running an ethnic conflict model on us. And they'll stay in power as long as they can distract us. They're traitors, and traitors are kind of cagey and hard for people to catch on to.
There's traitors amongst every race, wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Even to some extent, I would say, to the Jewish people. The elite Jews, I don't think, care much for their own people as they do for their own wallets.
Indeed. There's work out there about the Zionists who were fully good with leaving some Jewish people in Nazi Germany to die. You can see it in the Jewish elite if you bring up the name Noam Chomsky and see how the Jewish elite furrows their brow and gets upset. They see him as a traitor because he doesn't go with what they want us to believe about them.
Yeah, well, Noam Chomsky was the guy that said, who cares, when they spoke about 9/11, and then said, who cares, when they mentioned Kennedy's assassination.
Sounds like it.
Noam Chomsky has controlled opposition.
Absolutely.
I don't think he's controlled, though.
It's okay to say the white people run the world and it's white people that are behind it, but you can't say it's the Jews, can you? And the problem is that it is the Jews, okay? Well, because it's like a corporate takeover. The Jews have taken over, and I'm not saying they're not clever, and I'm not saying it's all Jews, but this is Jewish imperialism. It's about Israel. We've had Pax Britannica, we've had Pax Americana, and now we're going to have Pax Judaica. And that's the way the world empire's running. And you've got to be able to admit, you see, it's okay to say, why is it okay to say white people run the world? You have all these Hollywood movies promoting that idea, but it's not true.
It's not true? Then who runs the world, sir?
No. It's not true yet. Yeah. Look at the names, sir. Look at who's really running it. Just because they might look slightly pale, they make their allegiance very obvious. It's very obvious right now what's going on. We've almost got a reformation religiously. Even the Christian churches are now becoming Judaic. They're changing their...
I think I'm saying the opposite of what you're saying. All I'm saying is they are a part of it. I'm not saying they're the total end all be all. I'm saying they're part of it.
You've got to see it for what it is. You've got to look at this. Look at the last 100 years. Central banking, control of the media, the multicultural project, everything else. And I'm talking more from a European perspective. Mm-hmm. But this is very much an orchestrated agenda, and it's very clear who's in control of that agenda.
Yeah, another historical point that a lot of people miss is in the early days of Europe, the Jews weren't allowed to own land.
That's rubbish, man.
So, well, just hold on a second, and you can tell me it's rubbish, but let me finish the thought. And they started to get into early on banking, and so when the things switched from mercantilism to capitalism, they had all of the advantages because they had been working in banking and law, and they were able to use their families to kind of support that idea of keeping it in the family and having the advantage as far as moving money around. And before you knew it, they were the banking cartel.
That's a very cozy picture you've painted there. But the fact of the matter is, the Jews of today are kind of loosely related to the Babylonians of the Bible, who had set up their banking empire at that point in Jerusalem, which is why they want to go back there. Okay, so the Jews have always been powerful with money because that was their system, that and slavery. The Romans documented this very well. But you've got to ask yourself, if there was so much persecution against the Jews, why have the richest men in the world for the last 500 years all been Jews?
I think it's more of what I was just trying to state, and if you guys want to Google that tonight and look it up, I think you'll find that what I just told you was accurate. But
well, they definitely
I know even in the Bible.
The richest man in the world is a Lebanese guy living in Mexico. He lives in Mexico City in one of the most disgusting places in the world.
Look, man, the wealthiest people in the world, we don't know who they are. They've had money for so long and been drawing interest for so long. We have no idea. They're not on Forbes list. You know what I mean?
You're right there, Chad. The people on the Forbes list are just the people inside the system, not the people who control the system.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we have no idea what kind of wealth is out there. But there's generational wealth that we have no – man, we have – we don't know what they own, what they're into as far as, resources and production and control and just the interest that they draw on this money that's been around for, centuries. So we have no
idea. Hey, guys,
I want to
interject something on the article in the Jewish Virtual Library about money lending in a religious context. Deuteronomy 23:20 through 21 states, "You shall not lend on interest to your brother, interest of food or money or anything on which interest can be charged. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but not to your brother."
Interesting. Good info, man. And the Arabs, well, let's just say Islam has a similar rule, but that doesn't stop Saudi Arabia from drawing interest on their oil and oil reserves.
But who are the Saudi Arabians?
Now we can. that's a tough one. That's a tough one.
Anybody add to that conversation on who the Saudi Arabians are? They're Jews.
Let me go grab a beer, man.
All right, go ahead. I'm going to bring up another caller, 424. Welcome to the show, 424.
Yeah, that's me. I got cut off and I called back. This is Don.
Oh, okay. Hey, Don. Sorry about that. Not sure how that happened.
No
but,
problem.
Who are the Saudi Arabians?
You asking me?
Don. Yeah, go ahead, Don.
Very, very wealthy, influential people. That's who they are. And they've had a lot of dealings with apparently our two presidents, George W. and George Herbert Walker Bush. Very shadowy people, but
they're Wahhabi sect, right? And they were Jews, and then they converted to Islam, kind of like the Murano Jews who converted to Catholicism.
You know, I don't know any of that. I really don't know much about them at all. You're asking the wrong guy. Ask me something easy like...
not a problem.
Is there life after death, you know?
Yeah, they're a Jewish Semitic sect that converted to Muslim, kind of like a crypto-Jew, basically, the House of Saud.
There is one issue I would like to comment on. The other caller said that Jews... achieved great success in money lending and commerce because they were driven out of other professions. The version of history has been recently challenged. There's an interesting book just came out called A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History by Nicholas Wade. And he talks about genetics and how modern developments in genetics have enabled us to identify race. Because different groups of people we call races have common genetic kinds of composition, just like they have common physical characteristics that identify them. They also have common genetic markers. In any event, he discusses the issue of Jewish commercial success, and he references a book that was recently written by two historians named Bottesini and Eckstein. I think both of them are Jewish, and they said that they did a great deal of research, and they concluded that Jews were not forced into money lending, but rather chose it because it was extremely profitable. And they were not dispersed because of persecution, but because there were jobs for only so many money lenders in each town. He also made an interesting point that Jews were very good at mathematics and the calculations that are necessarily involved in commerce and money lending. And Arabic numerals, and I didn't know this, Arabic numerals were not widely used even in Europe until about 1600. That means the Roman numerals were used, and they don't have a zero. And higher level or even comparatively simple calculations are extremely difficult to do in Roman numerals, almost impossible. But the Jews mastered the art of calculating in Roman numerals, and they were able to achieve great success because genetically, they had a very high percentage of people with very high IQs. In 63 AD, there was a very powerful Jewish rabbi who issued a proclamation where he proclaimed that there should be universal male literacy among all Jews. And that's given an enormous amount, that had an enormous impact on elevating Jews and developing their abilities in the cognitive areas. And so that's kind of an interesting...
They have a lot of inbreeding
there. Well, they do, because they have very strict laws against racial marriage outside their race. I mean, sometimes that's more honored in the breach than in the observance, because you see a lot of wealthy Jews, they have their kids with Jewish women, and then they dump them in marry white blondes, their trophy wives. But yeah, that is true. They have some genetic problems. They are genetically predisposed to a number of Jewish specific diseases that are very debilitating. So, you know, what nature giveth nature apparently also taketh away. But that book by Nicholas Wade has been was only recently published, within about the last 90 days. And one of the arguments that he makes in this book is that all of this argument about racial equality and the cultural Marxist dialogue has suppressed discussion of these various issues about genetics and race. And he said he thought science should trump politics and racial self-interest and racial self-awareness, which I think is a very good point. So that's
he's talking to a brick wall. I mean, if you're in power and you're 5 foot two and your face is asymmetrical, but you got $10 billion in the bank, I mean, why would you want a system change? You wouldn't want a system change. You'd like it the way it is now.
Well, that's very true, and there are a lot of people who didn't like his book, and they commented on it very harshly, saying the book is bigoted and racist and all the usual epithets that are used to shut down discussion of very important issues. So you're right. There are a lot of people who don't want to change the system.
Hey, I also think that the Catholic Church implemented this whole anti-usury concept to elevate the Jew, personally, myself. To allow them to continue their usury, it seemed as if even the Catholic Church allowed the Jews to continue to practice banking and, you know, provide loans for their empire and whatnot.
Well, I think the whole the hostility toward usury is a little strange, because you really can't have a modern economy unless people with surpluses can make those surpluses available to be used by entrepreneurs and borrowers and people like that. I mean, most of us couldn't afford to pay cash for a house. We have to get, you know, a 30-year mortgage or whatever. And I mean, money is an asset. It's a value. And the idea that you should be able to use money, someone else's money, without paying for it, it's kind of ridiculous. It's like I should be able to live in somebody else's apartment and not have to pay rent, or drive somebody else's car and not pay for that, or go into the grocery store and be able to get food and not pay for it. So the whole usury thing is kind of a bogeyman, because you need to be able to assess a value of the use of money. I mean, I understand that can be taken to an excess, where you have a Jewish-controlled Federal Reserve system that prints money and loans it to the banks at 1%, and then they loan it to us at 30%. So I think that's a bit much. But that power does not come from the free market. That is not an inherent ill in the concept of interest on the use of someone else's property. That's just because they have a monopoly on the ability to print money, and they have the legal tender laws. So some distinctions have to be made in that regard. I would argue. That's what I would argue.
Right. So the concept is not evil. You're basically talking about the two sides of the negotiation table. If one side can force the other side to accept a ridiculous rate, then that's what we're going to have. We're going to have a situation to where things just won't ever come out any different than this group is pulling in this vast amount of the resources. So, yeah, it's not that the concept is evil. It's who's doing it and what they're doing. A payday loan guy is going to make money, you know?
Yeah, we don't know if Abraham Lincoln was Jewish or not, but he sure sounded like a Jew just by Abe, but at the same time, he did turn back down the banking interest of how much the Jews were going to charge him interest to fight the Civil War. He turned that concept down and created the greenbacks, from what I understand.
Yeah, he printed fiat money. And at that time, there was a huge industrial base in the north, huge steel industry, construction, railroads, all that sort of thing. And it didn't really result in monetary inflation so much as it resulted in a huge stimulus to the economy. But the stimulus came from the increase in physical productivity, not just because you printed money. I mean, the evil of the system we have now, it's like a Monopoly game. If one player at the table had a printing press sitting there, say he had a printer and he could just press a button and print out money, he would control the whole board very quickly. I mean, everybody understands that. And that's the best metaphor I've ever been able to design to explain how the Federal Reserve works. If one player at a monopoly table prints his own money, he owns the whole board. And that's essentially why you see all this wealth flowing toward Wall Street, toward the financial industries, because they have the ability to print money. They have the ability to contract it and impoverish the rest of us, and then expand it again and contract it again. And through the artifice of controlling the money supply, which is a legal monopoly that was given them by the Federal Reserve Act, they hold the entire rest of the economy hostage.
Right.
Correct.
And all propped up by the military, because without the military, you can't even address the rest of the world in that fashion. But since we do have the top military, we can force the rest of the world to accept it and use the dollar as their reserve notes. So,
for now,
yeah,
the petrodollar for now, and until China, Russia, and whatnot decide not to accept it anymore, like they've been talking.
Mm.
And then
there's a flip side to that China coin, though. Oh, go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that once the petrodollar is no longer accepted as the world currency, we're going to see gasoline prices at $7-$8 a gallon.
Yep. But the flip side to that whole Chinese idea, because people kind of worry about them deciding that they're going to turn away from us, they can't find another market like us. So they need us just as much as we need them. So they're going to ride it as long as we're stable. They're going to ride that horse.
Yeah, but also I would say that the Jewish influence in China has been there for at least a couple centuries.
Well, I don't know about Jewish influence in China, but I do know that we don't produce enough. The market value of what we produce and what we give to China is about one-third of the market value of what China ships here. And that's like going to the grocery store every week, buying $300 worth of groceries and putting $200 of it on credit. After a couple of years of that, The grocery store guy is going to look at you as being someone to whom he doesn't want to extend much more credit. And that's the big problem. We don't physically produce enough product to exchange for the product that we bring in from China. So they're not going to be able to continue to sell to us the way they have, because they're not going to continue to accept our IOUs for the same reason your local grocer wouldn't accept your IOUs at the rate of $200 a week indefinitely. He would go broke.
But his
situation.
Yeah, but the question is whether they dump their goods then. You see, that's the issue. That these cheap goods that they're making through slave labor, basically, there's no market like us, so they have to have us. They need us just as much as we need them. I don't think it's a thing of, okay, this is going to be a thing of declining returns. They have to have us to prop up that BS system they have.
Nobody has to pay money to workers to produce goods to give them to people who can't afford to pay for them. We saw that in the housing market here. Gazillions of people bought houses they couldn't afford, and the whole system imploded for that reason. There's a tremendous maladjustment of resources.
But did it implode, or were those loans predatory loans, as people now call them, or were those loans designed for that? You know, actual fact, did people sign up for these loans not knowing that ballooning rate that was going to hit them in a few years, they wouldn't be able to afford? They lose the house, bank sells it again, and we start at square one.
Doesn't matter whether you call it a predatory loan or call it something else. They sold people products they couldn't afford to pay for, and they knew at the time they would not be able to afford to pay for them, and the whole system collapsed.
Right,
I knew people in the
short
real
term,
estate
they made
field,
money.
But they, Well, the people who engineered the scam made money by making bad loans because they were bailed out by the government.
Right.
That's not a viable business model, to make loans to people who can't pay money back. I've never heard anybody who got rich by making loans that were not going to be paid back.
Hey, if
you knew when it was going to go bad and that you could get out of it, then I think it does work. I'm in Atlanta. I don't want to say the name of the company because I don't want to slander anybody, but there was a mortgage company in the building I was working at, and I would see the salespeople, they came in Camrys, and as they started to leave, you started to see Camaros, Corvettes, and different things, and it was all off of these people who would be coming in who you could easily tell could not afford these loans that they were being given. So, I mean, they knew when it was going to blow up, so... It's an easy hustle for them.
But you see, you say they knew. It didn't matter when it blew up. It mattered that they were able to be paid. They were able to sell worthless IOUs to the United States government in exchange for real money.
Yes.
This is not a business model making bad loans. This is a political model, and it only works when you are in partnership with a corrupt government that will take taxes from productive people and reward criminals.
And then you take Wall Street, who takes those bad loans and creates derivatives out of them and ship them out across the world, so the whole financial crisis becomes global when it finally hits, because Greece and some of those other countries didn't know what type of terrible loans they were taking on when they were taking that on, man. So Wall Street played a hell of a game on everybody.
There was a promise of an income stream. There was a promise of a future income stream, and people relied on that promise, and it was a bad promise because the money wasn't there, and the future income stream was not there because it was based on loans that would not be repaid. It was based on a fraud, and
right.
These people were able to perpetrate that fraud because of the political influence and power that they have, and until and unless we break the control, the Jewish control of the Federal Reserve Bank, and have honest money, we are not going to be able to solve any of our social problems, because they will always be able to loot us by means of their control of the ability to print money and force people to accept that money.
And did anybody go to jail yet from that?
No.
From that financial crisis.
That shows the tremendous power that these people have.
Exactly. Indeed.
Well, I think we all agree on that one. This is Padgo here. I'm still listening. Yeah, we all agree on that. It's the money, isn't it? It's the central banking system. And it's not just the Federal Reserve. It's the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements. It's a scam.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a global system, and I think Russia and China and a lot of these other countries are coming together, and there's going to be a block of people who are going to stop accepting the dollar and stop using the dollar, and that's going to be a very hard time for this country, and I think that might very well be the spark that precipitates some kind of a really nasty war. I think it would be unfortunately, the state of Israel now has nuclear submarines that could launch nuclear missiles. It would be a very simple thing for the Israeli Navy to launch a nuclear weapon on a city, and they could blame that on just about anyone they wanted to blame. Think about that.
Well, let me ask you guys this question. What does it mean that access to the sea was more important to Putin and Russia than being in the G20? Does that tell us something about the future as far as Europe and some of these other financial powers is concerned?
Well, access to the sea, you mean through the Black Sea?
Yeah.
And the Crimea? Well, historically, because of its geography, Russia has had a very difficult time getting access to the sea, because its only access is through the north, which is frequently frozen over, through St. Petersburg, which is bottled up in the Baltic Sea. They have to go through the straits between Denmark and either Norway or Sweden. And of course, on the whole northern coast, they have a long coastline, but it's all frozen over most of the year. So they have warm water ports on the east. I think Vladivostok is the. I don't have a map in front of me, so I'm going from memory. But yeah, access to the sea is very important for Russia. It always has been. And during the Civil War, interestingly enough, Lincoln had an alliance with Tsarist Russia, and the terms of that alliance were that if Great Britain came in to the Civil War on the side of the Confederacy, the Russians would go to war with the United States against Great Britain. And before they announced that alliance, the Russian Navy left its ports and sailed for New York and San Francisco, so that in the event of war occurred, that Navy would not be bottled up in the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, or in the far reaches of the Pacific. It would be safely domiciled within the continental United States in San Francisco and in New York.
Well, it does seem to me that there was a battle between the Rothschilds and the Romanovs. The Romanov was the last remaining monarch with the balls to take him on.
Well, that was the Bolshevik Revolution, I think you're referring to, correct?
Well, that's what ended it. That's what ended a long struggle between them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But but back during the Civil War, that wasn't that was quite a long time before, prior to the Bolsheviks. So the Romanov was a bloodline that occurred for a while that did appreciate American nationalism and the separation from the empire, and they did appreciate America at that time. Yes.
Yeah, great.
Okay, we've talked about a lot of different subjects, and we've been going on for over 2 hours. Is there anything else you guys would like to touch upon? We still got 45 minutes left on the Blog Talk archive.
Well, I've got to say it's been a good show. I think it's been a very good show to the listeners. It was good to have Chad's input. So, Chad, you're still online, are you, Chad? Is he gone?
Chad, are you still here? I see him still on in the call, so.
Oh, yeah.
He's probably getting a cup of coffee or something.
That's right. Yeah, don't blame him. I've got a cup of tea here.
Right on. David, we haven't heard from you in a while. Would you like to add some more? David?
Oh, hello, Nate. How you doing?
Good. We still got 45 minutes left on the Blog Talk archive, so.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Sorry, I'm just actually making a cup of tea myself. Definitely one of the best nights I've listened to in a long, long while. And I've definitely learned this evening off of Chad from a black point of view in that respect. It's been educational.
Right on. And we've got North Powell. I've got an echo. But North Powell makes a good point. Romanovs refused the First League of Nations after the defeat of Napoleon. It resulted in a few czars being poisoned and blown up.
Do you know a good source on that subject?
A good source? No, I really don't. But somebody else?
Well, I read there was a book about the history of Haiti by a black Jamaican Marxist named C.F.R. James, and the title of the book was The Black Jacobins, originally published in 1938. It's a very interesting story of the history of Haiti and the French Revolution and its war for independence and the various contentions between various factions. And he talks about some plot between Napoleon. There was some plot to assassinate the Tsar in order to invade India or something like that. And I'm kind of fading out here. I'm suffering from a bad memory. But when you talked about the Tsars being poisoned and blown up in the aftermath of the Congress of Vienna, is that what you were talking about?
No, the League of Nations.
Oh, that's in the aftermath of World War One. I mean, the Tsars were gone by then.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was kind of confused by that. I've got...
Hello? Yeah, looking at the Black Jacobins by C.F.R. James, he says that the French and British bourgeoisie were in the middle of a struggle for world supremacy that lasted over 20 years and devastated Europe. Bonaparte aimed at India, and having missed his first spring by way of Egypt, he won over Tsar Paul, and the two arranged to march overland and steal from the British that which had been stolen from the Indians. And then says Bonaparte couldn't fight in two hemispheres. The British basically, in collusion with Tsar Paul's son Alexander, organized the murder of the pro-French Tsar Paul. So yeah, there was an attempt to conclude an alliance between Napoleon, the French, and the Russians to march into India, And through the British, through their usual strategies of assassination and espionage and various kinds of things, so put the kibosh on that. So that's in the early 1800s. That's what I thought you were referring to. Hello? Am I still on?
I hear you. I believe he may have dropped from the call.
Oh, okay. Sorry to hear that. I gave
a
brilliant
monologue.
I'm not
really familiar all that much with that portion of history, but I find it fascinating.
Well, I'm glad you heard it.
and hopefully, I'm not near a computer, hopefully the chat room heard it too.
Yeah, it's always kind of disheartening to give some brilliant monologue and realize you're talking to an empty telephone, you know. So.
Wasn't the communist revolution in Russia propped up out of America? Americans, rich or ruling class Americans are the one that kept that going, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. I'm actually familiar that they funded a whole lot of it.
People like Henry Ford and some others got in there after that.
Yeah, funding the losing side is always quite profitable. Because it allows you to make your achievements with less opposition.
I don't know why there's not more resistance against the ruling class. You hear a lot of people cite Bolshevik Revolution and Marxism and various other things as a cause, you know, current conditions, but I don't hear a whole lot of, I mean, you got people like, you know, Walmart, the Walmart heirs. I don't believe they're Jewish, but I mean they're all into the open borders policy and all this other stuff. And I mean, if you walk into any Walmart after 9 o'clock, I mean it's probably about the most disgusting place you can go. It's full of all kinds of trash. But
you know where the globe is?
Oh, the world
below? Oh, there it is, right there. You're right. You ready that ice cream pie one?
I don't know, but did we finish?
Ice cream cake? You ate it all?